Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Danielle the Danimal and Yannick Swaggy Center.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast. We are live and in person in New York City. We have just finished a lovely Easter Sunday in my backyard whilst watching the men's final. And I am joined by, once again, my great friend, Andreja Petković. Petko, what a great week. You were down in Miami. So, first of all, give me just your thoughts on being down there and what it was like and all
that. The scoop.
Give me the scoop.
Give me all the tea. Spill the tea. Well, first of all, thank you for having me over for Easter. I would have been all alone and you invited me. It's a really nice of you. I came all the way from Brooklyn to Manhattan. So I arrived. Unfortunately, my flight was scheduled during the women's final, which was really unfortunate. I know. So you have to recap that for us. I watched the highlights yesterday, but I couldn't see that. But all in all, it was good vibes. The tournament looks much better. The first year when I played the Miami Open out in Hard Rock Stadium, it used to be in Key Biscayne, it was literally in a parking lot. It was not nice. The gym was in the basement. The courts were in the parking lot. It looked terrible. You were surrounded by concrete. There was no protection from the wind. It's always windy in Florida, so it was kind of a mess. Now the tournament looks great. They have all these stands outside. The courts look beautiful. They have trees. They have palm trees. So now the site looks really good. And the outside courts were packed. But for some reason, the stadium court during day sessions was always kind of empty. And that was really unfortunate. Yeah. And during the night, it was great. It was packed. The atmosphere was amazing all over the side. If you saw the crazy Andy Murray match that lasted 3 hours and 25 minutes or so, you would have seen that was the vibe on the outside court. So you had that atmosphere just on stadium court during the day sessions. For some reason, there was something off and something missing. That was the only little knock that I had, and that was unfortunate. Other than that, it was really fun being there. They made the best that they can, considering that it's still kind of in a parking lot. And now you have all the one thing I will say that is kind of weird. You have all, it's like surrounded by the skeleton of the Formula One.
Yeah.
So you see bits and pieces of where the track either is or is going to be, with stands that haven't been, you know, deconstructed, that are still up but not in their full glory.
Well, isn't it coming to Miami soon?
It's coming soon. So you have it. It's not fully built yet, but you already see bits and pieces, and it's like being surrounded by another sporting event but by the skeleton. That was the only thing that was a little strange.
Well, you've got that, and then you've got the actual stadium is the actual Miami Dolphins stadium.
So you have two sporting events surrounding one sporting event that is happening at the time.
it'd be nice if they almost built another stadium there specifically for tennis.
Yeah, well, it is like a cool,
You've been there.
It's like, for some, it's unfortunate because it is a football stadium. If you are in a seat, in a bad seat, you can be really far away from the tennis court. But the atmosphere is kind of cool because the players are all, now they've built the restaurant and the players' lounge onto the grass, like onto the football field, basically. They have an indoor players' lounge as well, but they have sofas there with tents, so the players are hanging out on the grass more. They're right there at the stadium court. So it's like a cool thing to be there, you know. You can sense, it feels much more like a tournament. Before, it really felt like a completely disjointed animal where you were like, are we playing a tournament here or are we just appearing for an exhibition? It was kind of strange. Now they made a great effort in having it feel much more organic. So there is a good thing that it's there, but you know, you see the other sporting events kind of imposing onto the tennis at all times.
Yeah. Yeah, I think ideally it would be great to have an actual stadium down there, like actually built for tennis. just because we're talking about suites, right? You make a lot of money from suites. You make a lot of money from bringing clients into the tennis. For example, at the tennis, at the US Open, you know, you go into the suites. It's the Emirates suite. It's the Amex suite. It's the Rolex suite. It's the ESPN suite. It's all of the stuff, right? So there, the suites are so far from the court. It sort of feels a little disjointed. So I think what they're doing is amazing, and I think they're trying, but I think ideally, if they could build a separate stadium for the actual center court, I think that would make it better. But anyway, listen, as you said, look, the players were all said how happy they were. The only player that was not happy was Rude. He was rude to the umpire. He was just like, listen.
He was not that rude. he was actually a polite.
He was rude as someone from his country can be.
Yeah.
But he was basically like bitching about the being able to go off the court because the courts are so far from the main area, the outside courts. You've got to like get a golf cart basically to take really you there far. And back. That there's a designated spot, I'm sure, for the outside courts to go to a trailer probably, and it's not air conditioned, they don't have towels, they don't have water, and he was a little upset about that. So I don't blame him in that regard, but look, as I said, I'm no James Blake, who's a former player, and if you've ever been a former player, you know exactly, and not only a former player, but a high-ranked former player that would probably expect things to be a little bit nicer. So I'm sure he's trying his best to sort of accommodate the players, and as you just said, they're doing their best down there.
They are doing the best. It's a little bit unfortunate. If they were a single tournament in the middle of the calendar, I think it would be less glaring, the differences. When you come from Indian Wells, however,
you're coming from the best tournament of the year,
where a stadium and a tennis site was built with exactly that in mind. Yeah. We want to have one of the biggest tournaments here. How can we make it the friendliest for fans and players alike? That's what you can tell that the site was built for. And then coming to something where you have to make do with what you have is just it's hard for James to deal with.
You're right. If Miami was played in July, it would probably be, oh, this is great, we love it here, and it's Miami, and you gotta love being down in Miami, going to the beach, you know, playing golf. Like, there's a lot of things the players can do. Anyway,
and I have to say, players love Miami, especially male players. I wonder why.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
We'll let you think about that, viewers and listeners. I just want to shout out to a gentleman that came up to me on the street here, literally around the corner from my apartment, grabbed my arm, and he said, I love you. I love your podcast. So whoever that gentleman was, you didn't give me your name, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. You're on basically 12th and 3rd, and you came up to me. So thank you, sir, for coming in and grabbing my arm. And for anybody out there that notices me or Petco, we always are very happy and to hear those comments. But anyway, let's get into it. Let's start with the women first of all. Do we want to talk a little bit about what Sabalenka went through the last couple of weeks? Let's start there. Look, it's been a tough month for her. She has not played well over the last month since winning the Australian Open. We thought that she was going to just knock everybody out of the park the way she played at the Australian Open, but she's really struggled. You have to wonder this situation with the we're assuming ex-boyfriend, because the rumor was that she broke up with him.
She confirmed it on Instagram that they were no longer together when the tragedy happened. Yeah. So
you wonder how much that was also happening prior to him coming, and you know what happened in Miami happening, how tumultuous things were happening in her personal life, maybe affecting her on the court in the Middle East, then in Indian Wells. And then, of course, Miami was just, I didn't even know how she was able to function that week. Mm. I mean, even if you broke up with someone, if you feel, you would have to feel any kind of sense of responsibility for maybe what he did, which is crazy because you have no control over what somebody does. But that would have to have weighed on her mind. There's no question. And it was just a tough week for her.
Yeah, it was super tough. And she was wearing the hat. She never wears a hat.
And
she,
so low.
Super low. So you could see that she wanted some protection. But she also wanted to play and wanted to honor her commitment. And I think also she probably felt somewhat safe on the court where she doesn't have to think about it or she has to think about other things. I can imagine that that is something that can give you relief for a few hours, at least I hope. And you know what? I can't fathom what Arina went through. I wrote about it in my previous Substack a little bit. I had sometimes private struggles that nobody knew about, and it was hard to function just knowing it yourself.
Yeah.
But being out there in the public eye and everyone knew what happened, everyone is speculating, yeah. Everyone is wondering.
Like, and not like just a breakup. We're talking like the guy killed himself.
Yeah.
Like it's not like, oh, you know, yeah, it's a breakup or sad, you know, he had a fight with her or what. This is what happened
tragedy,
to him.
An
absolute tragedy.
Yeah.
And a very, I don't even know how to describe, like someone doing that to themselves, you know, and yes, everybody knows about it. And you can't just hide.
No.
Like you said, when something's happening in your own personal life, you take it home with you.
Mm.
You go back to your hotel, but nobody's talking about it to you.
Mm.
Everybody knew about this story.
Yeah.
So it's not like she could hide and be like, hey, how's it going? She couldn't even lie and be like, hey, it's great. She was just like, they're like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, everyone.
I will say what was really nice to see and witness was how the tennis world, and we are all egotistical creatures in this world, but the tennis people really gathered around Arina. I saw a lot of them going up to her, hugging her, you know, being there for her. The WTA made it possible for her to start a day later. She didn't have to do press. Like, whatever was in that power to help her and protect her and give her some kind of support, which is impossible to support somebody, but just somehow in the smallest ways that you have, I felt like the tennis world was doing and trying that. And that was nice to see that we are able to gather around our peers in times of need. It at least seemed like that from my perspective, being around the side. That was nice to see. But yeah, incredible. And I just hope that she has the support system around her to deal with it, whether that be professional help or family and friends. And hopefully we will see her smile very soon again.
Yeah, let's hope. Because, you know, we love her personality. Personality and everything, and as I said, that's not on her what happened, and I hope she knows that. But listen, also, you know, another
but
person.
Well, and maybe we should also say condolences to Konstantin's
family.
That was family and friends and everyone around him.
Yeah, we saw him a lot.
Yeah, he was part of the tennis world.
Yeah.
You know, he was part of the tennis world. So it was a big shock, and I think it kind of overshadowed the first. Not overshadowed. That's the wrong word. But it was on everybody's mind and the first week of the Miami Open, for sure.
Yeah, because, you know, you realize, and that's one of the things, we'll get to Danielle Collins in a second, but one of the things that she's spoken about a lot of late is that there's so many bigger things happening outside of the tennis world, and she's become very well adjusted as a human being and realizing that, and you see it on the court from her. But I want to wait in talking about Danielle. I want to talk about some of the players that really have been struggling. Ons Jabeur, again, just struggling on the hard court. I know, look, her favorite surfaces are coming up, clay, grass. She always plays well on them. We were worrying about her last year, and then she won Charleston, and then she, you know, played great and made the finals of Wimbledon again, and et cetera. But still, it's what's going on?
Well, I was calling a match that was at the same time, so I couldn't really see her. She lost to Avanisyan in the third set. I will say Avanisyan is a very dangerous player in the sense that she is a counter puncher and she uses your pace. And I felt for a while that Ons is lacking clarity on the court, and
great.
She is somebody that has the game to beat a counter puncher because she can slow the game down. She has different sorts of variety in her game. But if you lack in clarity, the thing you do is hit hard, hit flat, hope that it goes through, and it's the worst thing you can do against Avanisyan. Granted, I didn't see the match. I wonder what you think about Ons.
Yeah, I mean, same thing. I just think that she's lost the clarity and the confidence in what she's doing. Look, I think I'll assess more about her tennis after Charleston that she won last year. If she doesn't do well that week, then you start thinking, okay, what's going on? And obviously she plays great on clay. So, well, I'm not as concerned about her yet, but certainly it's a disappointment because she has not done well for a while now. So
she's in a really tough section though. She is awaiting, so she has a bye in the first round of Charleston, and she's awaiting the winner of Danielle Collins and Paula Badosa.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, and this is what happens so often in tennis. You lose confidence, you lose a few matches, a few things go wrong, and all of a sudden it seems like everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Like everything conspires against
get
you.
Get a bad draw, get a bit of an injury, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, we'll see. But as I said, we'll make an assessment more so, I think, after...
On her favorite surfaces.
Yeah, on her favorite surfaces. Also, Rybakina coming back. She's, look, had these emotional ups and downs of the sickness and whatever it is. But she came back, battled in this tournament, battled to get to another final. Got to give her a lot of credit. But I did tweet out, and I know I'll get in trouble for this because I've given him shit in the past about, you know, his negativity and stuff, but her coach. If I had a coach, when I looked over and I was missing my best shot, and she was struggling with her backhand, like that's her best shot by far. If I look over and my coach is gesturing on a regular basis and showing, you know, the people, he has a tendency to talk to everybody in the players' box. I don't know why he wants to tell them all what's happening and what she's doing wrong or what she's doing right or when it's good. And I remember the Australian Open when she got that match point against when she lost to Blinkova. And I remember there was one match point, maybe her sixth match point or something. And they all started laughing in the box because they were like, okay, this is it now. We're finally going to win, right? And they all laughed. They were all laughing in the box. And I'm like, never in my effing life as a coach or as a player am I laughing until the match is over. And I remember thinking that. I'm like, why are you laughing? Like, yeah, chances are she's probably going to win the next point, but chances are she might not. So you cannot have these emotional ups and downs on a tennis court. And then to look over in the final when she was struggling a bit, and he's gesturing with her back, with the backhand, like showing, I'm moving my arms, like gesturing a backhand. If I'm having a problem with my backhand and I look over and my coach is gesturing with the backhand, I'm like, I fucking know. I know I'm missing it. Like, why do you need to keep? I want to look over and see my coach go, you have the best backhand in the world. You got this. You got this. I remember with Sam, for example, she would miss some forehand returns. And she said to me one time, she goes, don't tell me too much with it. Just tell me you got this. You've got this. And that's all you want to hear in these very stressful moments, that you got this. You're great. You're going to be okay. I don't want to look over and see my coach gesturing and basically letting everybody in the entire stadium know, yeah, I'm missing my backhand and it's shit today. Like, I don't know how she does it. I don't know how she deals with the negative coming at her way. But my God, it doesn't help. It does not help. But I give her credit because, God, she keeps her shit together because of it, because she's such a great player. But I just keep thinking, God, if she had someone on the side just being super positive with her, maybe she would win a match like that. Maybe she would dig herself out of a hole. I don't know.
Well, she definitely played the match of the tournament. It was the best effing women's match I've seen in a long time. I think it was the match of the whole year as of now. Elena Rybakina, Maria Sakkari.
Oh, yeah.
What in the world? They were hitting the crap out of the ball. They were playing so well. They were serving well. It was like next level.
It
felt
good.
Like tennis from the future or something. And I was like, oh my God. And the same day, the same day on Tennis Channel, Prakash called Sakkari as the winner. And I normally agree with him. And I said, and I don't like, can't be contrarian, so I normally just go with it, whatever, but I really felt
that
like Elena was going to win, and I said, oh, I have to be a contrarian here and disagree. I think Rybakina will win, and I was never this nervous during a match because I just hoped I was going to be right, and I was.
Yeah, that was next level
that
tennis.
That was insane tennis.
And you know it when two players like that, they were both very liked in the locker room, very liked on tour. There's not one player that could say something bad about either of those two players. They're both great kids. They both work their asses off. They're just good kids. And they battled. And they walked to the net, and the way they shook hands and the way they looked at each other was almost like, That was a great match.
It was a great
match.
That
was a great, great. It could be the best match of the year.
I think it was, as of now, I think it was obviously the other great match was, again, Rybakina with the Blinkova. That was the drama of it, right?
Oh,
the quality was
Open.
not as high, but the drama of a 38-minute tiebreak is insane.
I forgot about that.
Yes, but
how could I?
Quality-wise, from first point to last, for almost 3 hours, 2 hours, 51 or whatever it was absolute insanity. But it sapped a lot of energy of Elena. She played all tournament long. She played these 2.5 hour matches, 2:40. She was sick in Iowa, so she couldn't really practice for a few days. So she was struggling. And then when she found her stride against Madison Keys, she looked really good. Yeah. So such clean hitting. And I was like, oh, she's going to win this tournament. She looks like so good. And then the match against Sakkari.
Yeah.
It was
just next level.
It was next level. It was so good, but it took a lot of out of her. But even if it hadn't, she faced somebody in the final that was on a mission.
On a mission. Before we get to Danielle, though, can I just – I texted you. I don't need to tweet to you. I texted you about
– Yeah, I don't give my number to Renee.
Yeah.
We have a podcast together, but she doesn't have my number.
Madison Keys is got to be the most frustrating person in the world to coach. And I say this with total respect and love for Madison Keys because she's a great kid, an amazing hitter of the tennis ball. Like, nobody hits the ball harder and bigger. But boy, oh boy, she frustrates me. Because in the biggest moments in both sets against Rybakina, Rybakina would hit a great return down the middle of the court or deep into the court. And Maddie Keys is trying to hit an inside out or down the line forehand or backhand off of that shot and misses it wide. And it's like, oh. The times that she lost her serve, all she had to do is think, that's a great return coming at me. I've got to rip this down the middle of the court. Like, I cannot go to the line. I cannot hit over the high part of the net. I've got to be disciplined and go back cross court or through the middle. No, not Madison. She tries to hit the hardest shot in the history of tennis off the most important points. I don't get it. I don't get why. I mean, at 20, you get it, right? Because... you know, 20 as a teenager, you're just a dummy, right? You just make the dumbest decisions. But now you're a Grand Slam finalist, multiple Grand Slam semifinals, multiple Grand Slam quarterfinalists. You've got to figure out a way to hit those balls in the court. And I don't understand how she hasn't figured that out yet.
Well, Maddie was injured. We give her that. She had the shoulder injury in the first few months because I really liked what I saw during the U.S. series last year. And she had a sneaky good year. She won Eastbourne. She played quarters in Wimbledon. She played semis at the U.S. Open. So she had a sneaky good year. And in the U.S. series, Fratangelo, her fiance Bjorn, he started coaching her and I could see a difference. And I was like, oh my God, she's finally listening. So I will give her that. So let's give her a few more weeks to adjust with the injury. She hasn't played, she has only played 3-4 matches this year.
She's a former champion of Charleston.
But she's nowhere near as frustrating as Caroline Garcia. She is the most frustrating. She is the best server on the WTA Tour. I'm not just throwing it out there. Her and Rybakina are on position 1 and 2 in every single serve department. So first percentage points won, second percentage points won, service games won. They exchange 1 and 2 in every single department, right? So her and Rybakina are, statistically speaking, the best servers. Return, Garcia is ranked outside the top 100.
No way.
I swear to God, we were looking at these stats. It was Martina Navratilova, me, and I don't remember who. And we was looking at these stats and we couldn't believe our eyes. She's ranked 104 in return stats on first serve points won. And she's ranked 97.
Oh, that's no way.
97 on second return points won for the last 6 months. And she refuses to take a step back. She refuses. And in the match against Danielle Collins.
Yeah, give it to us.
She won only one single point on Danielle's first serve. One single point the entire match. And her coach, before that point that she won, her coach got up and screamed at her.
What did he scream?
Go back a step, putain. Go fucking back. Take a step back. She took a step back. She made the return. She won the point. And then she went back to the baseline and lost the next 27 points on first serve that Danielle played. That's and I just, if you are standing there and you're winning matches, and you're winning points and you're ranked in the top 20 and this is the way you play, more power to you. But you're a top 20 player who can barely make a return game. You have to ask yourself what is happening.
That is crazy. That's a crazy stat. Thank you for that. And, you know, if you're a coach and you're seeing that and you're saying that to a player and they're not responding to it, like, oh, maybe I should change my positioning on the return or maybe I should try something different, then you don't deserve to win matches. Because why have a coach? Like, honestly, that's just crazy. Anyway.
The thing with her is that, and I said it a few times, the thing with her is, and I think that's her problem, she still wins matches because, as we just mentioned, she's one of the best servers in the world. And if she somehow gets to a break point and her positioning is threatening and somebody serves a double fault, she will win the match because she serves so well that it's really hard to break her. And you will see she wins oftentimes matches 6-4, 6-4, one break each, you know. However, the problem is this type of player has never gone further than quarterfinals in a Grand Slam tournament. Why is that? Or maybe she made semis at the US Open once. I'm not sure. But why is that? She should have had 5 Grand Slam titles. And the reason is, if you play this high risk of a game during a fortnight of a tournament,
yes,
a major tournament is 2 weeks long, you will have a bad day.
Yeah.
And other players win on a bad day, and Garcia loses every single time. And that's why she's never won a Grand Slam, because with the talent she has, she should be a multiple major tournament
or at least have won one.
Or at least have won one,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think that's her problem, because on a 7 days, you saw it, you can catch lightning in a bottle in 7 days. And then when she plays well,
and she's done it.
She's done it.
She
because
won the WTA finals.
Yes. Like, because she won Cincinnati from qualies.
Yeah, I know, because she beat you.
She beat me, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like she was serving so well. And that's the thing. She saw the ball so big. She was in such high confidence. You couldn't break her, right? And so when you can't break her, she will break you at one point.
Yeah.
But it's such a high-risk game that if you do have a bad day, it's really hard to win a major tournament. And I think this is the standard I'm putting to Garcia. I'm not putting a standard of a random top 20 player. I think she should be a major tournament winner. And she isn't. And it frustrates me, because you were talking about frustrating players, because I do think if she could just, she doesn't even have to be top 10 in the return games one, because she's such a good server. It's enough if you're 45.
I think you're annoyed because you were such a great returner and your serve let you down sometimes, that you would have like given your left arm or maybe your left pinky, because you need your left arm to hit your two-hander, to have her serve.
Well, with both of that's absolutely true. And with both, with Madison Keys and Caroline Garcia, they are 500 times more talented than I ever was. And so I had to do everything right.
Yeah.
And then it frustrates me to see these players who don't do everything right, but are still better than I ever was because they have more talent. And it's unfortunate, but in tennis, it's a meritocracy. You either have talent or you don't. I can't create a magic potion, drink it, and become the best tennis player in the world. I did the best I could, and I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
But I never had there. And so sometimes when I watch them, I was like, if I had an ounce of their talent, I would have been the number one player in the world for 10 years, because I had to do everything correct,
yeah,
in order to keep up with the best in the world, even for a little bit of a short period of time, you know?
Yeah. Well, anyway. So let's get to our girl, Danimal. Danielle.
Iconic.
Or as we call her, Danielle Collins. How great was those 10 days for Danielle Collins?
Iconic. Absolutely,
I mean,
iconic.
She's been through hell. Last 3 years, 4 years, the endometriosis, the rheumatoid arthritis.
Yes.
She's got lots of issues going on.
Autoimmune disease.
Like, you know, she won the Australian Open. And something that I thought was interesting yesterday, she thanked the crowd.
She lost in the final of the Australian Open.
Literally the longest speech of all time. But we'll get to that. But she lost in the Australian Open, and I was there for that match, courtside, working. And I think 4 or 5, maybe 7 people were screaming for her. And she had this little band of guys as well. So she probably had about 15 people cheering for her. And then the rest of the 15,000 people were cheering for Ash Barty. And every time Ash Barty would win a point, it was like the roof went. It's the loudest I've ever heard Rod Laver Arena, ever. Then Danielle Collins would win a point. It was crickets. Like, I've never heard a stadium so quiet. Because Australians are pretty, we're parochial, but we're also very fair.
Yeah, that's
true. It's kind of like the English.
Well, it's like a great sports country. Yeah. They know how to respect sports people. Like I always say it as an example, when you have an on-court interview with a player, in every other country, people just leave because they want to see other matches. Australians always, like, every single person stays for the on-court interview. It's insane.
Yeah, we like our sports and we're fair. Mm. But that Australian Open was
different.
So unfair. And, you know, look, I don't blame her. It's Australian Open and it was Ash Barty and it's the first time Australian had won for 30 years or something, so or more. And so I get it. But she must have felt so amazing playing that final yesterday because – the crowd were going bonkers for her. Mm-hmm. And it was so nice for her to hear. She grew up 3.5 hours drive up the west coast of Florida in St. Petersburg, Florida. Not wealthy, very poor family, busting her ass. Went to college because she probably had no means really to go on the tour. And it's very expensive to be a tennis player. She goes, she plays college, she dominates in college, she plays great, she changes colleges. Like she's had a bit of a, you know, interesting way to get into professional tennis. Then she comes out on the tennis tour and does pretty well, like plays well and she's got that attitude and chutzpah and the come on and the whole thing. And then I feel like she had that, the sickness and the, you know, issues with the surgery, with the endometriosis. And then when I saw her play in the last few years, she didn't have that same fire. And I spoke to her about it and I think she realized that she didn't want to be seen like that on the tennis court anymore, or seen like this, you know, hothead and sort of loud and brash American and all this stuff that can come with Danielle Collins of 5 years ago. And I think she's kind of like got really calm on the court, and I think it hurt her in some ways, but I think it's taken her a long time to get to the point, and you could see it here where she still had the fire, but she was super calm the whole time.
She was incredible, yeah.
Until the last game.
Yeah.
When then we saw Danimal come out, where she was like screaming in her box, like, talk to me. And then she's like, shut up, sit down. It was like they didn't know whether to stand up, whether to sit down, whether to cheer for her, whether to not say anything. It was classic. And it's something as a tennis player we both knew, because we were both pretty volatile on the court, or we'd get fired up, where you're like, it's got nothing to do with your player's box. It's just you're so stressed out.
You just need to let it out on somebody.
And you're the one. You're the people sitting there, so you're going to cop it. And it was classic Danielle Collins last game, and she hits the most amazing backhand cross court to win the match, and she just played unbelievable.
She lost the first set of the tournament, and then she didn't lose more than 3 games until the final per set.
That's
it was like she was a level.
It was like Iga Swiatek.
Yes, she was a level above every single person there. Against Caroline Garcia too. Like even in the rallies, like in the beginning we were saying, oh, you know, whose forehand can hold up better because both are struggling on the forehand. Danielle was overpowering Garcia over the backhand side, and that's really hard to do.
Danielle Collins' backhand is probably one of the greatest backhands ever.
It's unbelievable. But she was just like, the thing was, when she has a bit of time, she's always incredible. But even on like the quick, hard shots that are played with a lot of depth and flat, when she can be a little late because she has these big swings, she was seeing the ball so early. She was there. She smacked it right back. And then she had this really nice little change of rhythm. Not that she plays with a change of rhythm, but she has this little angle with the backhand. Yeah. So sometimes she would just go like, whoops, with a flick of the wrist
and
open
really
up
well.
The cross court.
That I don't know. So many big servers don't use it enough. She was using the body serve more than any player I've ever seen over the last couple of years. She played it unbelievably well against Alexandrova. Mm-hmm. She served that serve 100 times. Like, Alexandrova couldn't get out of the way. And for anybody out there that has a player serving to your body, take a half a step back.
Yeah.
Just a half a step back. It makes the world of difference.
Say that to Caroline Garcia.
Take a half
a step
back. She
did the same against her. And the thing with Danielle's serve is, and it's interesting because she can also serve kick, but she has a great size. And the way she serves the body serve, she hits it as hard as she can, but with a tad bit of slice. Yeah. And so you think you're in place, but then it moves just into your right hip. And if you play tennis and imagine a ball coming to your right hip, you cannot do anything.
No.
You can't move out of the way to hit a backhand. And the forehand, you're so close to your body, you can't swing. And you always give a short ball. And if you give Danielle a neutral ball, you're
done.
Toast.
Yeah, and it's actually a serve. It was one of my best serves. Danielle and I serve pretty similarly. I loved the flatty, like pancake flat serve when I was serving at my best. I could hit the slider pretty well, and I love the flat one, but then I used to hit this, and I hit the body serve a lot under pressure because I could smack it as hard as I could. And I knew. So,
and sorry to interrupt you, this is really important.
Yeah.
If you listen to Renee, but also listen to me, if you are going for a body serve, you have to hit it.
Yeah.
Because the one thing what you want to do with a body serve, you want to jam the other person. So if you just slice it and they have the time to take a step back and hit it, you're dead. So that's why take an example in Renee and in Danielle. You have to smack the ball when you hit a body serve.
Smack it. I love to hit that shot because I either got a mistake off the return, which a lot of these girls, and particularly on the forehand, a lot of the girls don't like to hit that one, or I got a short ball. And for me, as somebody who was serving and volleying and coming in, I got a ball that was high often, and also that it was very hard for them to hit a winner. Just a straight up winner, unless you don't hit your spot on the serve or you don't hit it hard enough.
If you miss it
a bit dead. But it's a serve that I think she used beautifully all week. And Alexandrova, who took out Iga Świątek, who we didn't even talk about. I mean, Iga, that was just, anyway, there was too many other people to talk about, but certainly, you know, coming off of winning Palm Springs and then losing early, she's going straight onto the clay. She's going to be fine. But that's why we sort of didn't really talk about her very much. But I just want to give so much credit, so much kudos to Danielle, because to finish that match off the way she did and to hang in there in that last game, because she was up 30 love and she kind of got a bit tied on the forehand. She had a short forehand. She hit it straight to Rybakina, and that got down to break point. And that's when all the drama started. But just well done, Danielle. Like, well done. She's going to retire at the end of this year. And a lot of people keep asking why, you know, especially now they're going to be like, why would you retire? You're playing great. She has two very chronic diseases. And at some weeks, you talked about it in Austin, she like just fell apart because her body fell apart.
I was calling Austin and we were like, oh, Danielle Collins is winning this tournament. She was so much better than everyone. She was playing well. She had won a lot of matches already. She was playing well in the Middle East. And then she wakes up on quarterfinals or even I think second round and she had a flare up and you could just see she was in pain. She didn't sit down on changeovers. Yeah. Her back was hurting. Then her hip was hurting. Then her knees were hurting. And she ended up retiring, I think, in the quarterfinals or maybe not really playing at her best. And that's what happens. And the thing is with that, I never had an autoimmune disease, thank God. But I know a few of my friends who have it, and it saps you mentally and energetically because you wake up every morning. And I had chronic knee pain, which was obviously not the same, but similar in a sense that I woke up in the morning. The first thing I did was not like, oh, I have to pee. I would wake up and test my knee and be like, today is bad. Today I can't practice what I planned. Or, oh, great, today I can practice. And that times a billion is what an autoimmune disease as a tennis player or as an athlete, as a pro athlete, where you're like, can I practice this week? Can I play this week? Or will I be in bed for the next five days? And that's just horrible. And it saps you mentally and energetically and emotionally, just the ever questioning, can I do it or can I not do it? And so I think that's part, I think that she never mentions it in that way, but I do think that's part of why.
Yeah, and she wants to get pregnant and there's all this sort of stuff. But look, the bottom line is I'm so happy for her that she now can walk away from this game. Maybe at the end of the year, maybe she'll change her mind. Maybe she'll have found some magic potion that helps her, you know, on a weekly basis. I don't know. But if she does retire at the end of this year and puts her rackets down at 30, 31 years of age, gets, you know, married, has kids, whatever, and is happy, good for her that she was able to say, you know what? I was a pretty fucking good tennis player.
Yeah.
And look how well I played. Made a finals of a Grand Slam. And I won a WTA 1000, and not just a random WTA 1000, not like a Guadalajara where like two people go sometimes and play, like no offense to Maria Sakkari who won that last year, but like everyone was, no, there was barely anyone there. And everybody played Miami.
And beating Elena Rybakina in the final, a Grand Slam champion.
All the players she beat through the whole tournament was fantastic. So Danielle, we're giving you a fist pump, a well done. Because,
and I have to say one more thing about her personality. I always liked her because what
too.
I liked about her is she was very authentic and very true to herself. And this is what I want to circle back to. When Danielle came on tour, she was not well liked, neither by players nor by fans. And now she has icon status, and that's just my appeal to people and to tennis players who come on tour. But generally, really as people, that sometimes the others have to come around to you if you are true to yourself.
And be yourself.
That's what I mean. Like, in the beginning, people were like taken aback because she was loud and yelled in your face and wanted to win and was feisty. Now everyone likes her. And all the fans, there's so much outpouring love for her because she always remained true to herself. And people will come around when they see that's who you are and you go, girl.
And you know what? Look, she has definitely calmed down a lot on the court. There's no doubt about it. And I think she's matured in that way. But she also came out of playing college. And you look at Peyton Stearns, who's going to take over from Danielle as far as the same sort of personality. And they've come out of college and constantly, if you've ever gone to watch a college match, they're constantly yelling and screaming at one another. Yeah. Go five, go four, like, yeah, you know, whatever. Go Gators, go, you know, Gamecocks, go Cardinals.
Just go watch a college match. Like, the first time I saw it, I was dying of laughter because after every point, it was like 15 all, and the teammates would jump off the bench and run on the court. And I was like, what is happening here?
It's just,
so this is the atmosphere they come from.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you're going to bring that to the tour and be surprised that the others are not doing that.
Yeah, especially when you're a really good player in college. So you're like, well, this is what wins me matches. And I think she's learned through the last few years that, oh, I don't need to necessarily be like that. But what she needed to be was calmer. And that's what has won her a lot
of matches. The combination right now in Miami was the perfect combination of you heard the legendary commands. Like, I ventured to argue that there was one against Garcia that was maybe the all-time number one, where she like did a half Ivanovic lifting the knee up and then a half like pulling back the fist
the
and yelling come on. So there was like a lot of things mixed melanged into one. It was so beautiful. I loved it. But with the calmness in between, right?
Yeah.
And she found the perfect mixture for herself where she has the feistiness but also a certain kind of zen within her.
And one thing to remember if you are raising a tennis player or you listen to this podcast and you want to aspire to be a professional, if you're a feisty person like Danielle Collins, like I was, like you were, you know, on the court, remember to use those moments to change the atmosphere of a match, right? Because when Danielle Collins maybe, you know, is kind of calm, and then goes, come on, that one time, as an opponent, you're like, oh, shit, right? So use those moments of feistiness at the right time because it can influence a match big time, right? And never lose sight of who you truly are. You don't want to lose who you truly are when you're playing a tennis match, but you want to control the controllables. And also, if getting upset is hurting you, then that's a bad thing. But don't lose the feistiness when it matters. And that's a big lesson that I think Danielle's learned through the year. So well done to Danielle Collins. I'm super, super happy for her. All right, let's flick over to the guys. I mean, come on, Jannik Sinner. He just destroyed Grigor Dimitrov today. But before we get to that, Alcaraz losing to Grigor Dimitrov. How happy are we for Grigor Dimitrov? Before we get to Grigor, let's talk about Andy Murray a little bit, though, because, you know, unbelievable couple of matches that he played, that 3-hour 20 match, and then he ended up losing to Mahach. This guy is unbelievable. Then his ankle's fucked up now. He's hoping, obviously, to try and get back for Wimbledon, because I think that's going to be the last time we see him on the tour. He's sort of really saying now that this is it. How much do you just love this guy? And when he won that match prior to losing the one he did, I said, this is why he still plays. He goes out and he's throwing his fists in the air and he's jumping in the air and the crowd's going crazy for him. You can't not admire the guy. And hopefully he's back with this ankle injury now for Wimbledon.
I think he will be. I mean, it was super unfortunate. He twisted or rolled his ankle and two ligaments are torn. So he will be out for a few weeks, but hopefully it's not a ligament injury that requires surgery, because that can take you out 3 months. If it's not that bad, he can get away without a surgery, and he might be even back in 5-6 weeks. Actually, I had it once where I tore two, and I was back after 5-6 weeks. When I did all three, I had to have surgery, and it was like a whole ordeal. So let's hope it's not that. But what I will say from a fan perspective, I was in Miami when Andy Murray played. All the courts were packed and the atmosphere always rang all over to the stadium court, where we were like, oh, what is that? Oh, yeah, Andy Murray is playing. Yeah. Fans know what they get when they buy an Andy Murray ticket.
Yeah.
They get a Greek tragedy and somebody will die. at the end of a match. And most of the times, it's Andy Murray. Unfortunately.
Or his fans.
Or one of his fans. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. And so that's why it's like the discussion of, first of all, his ranking is good enough to not need wildcards anymore. But the discussion of not giving Andy Murray wildcards, like, that is the one ticket I would buy as a fan. I will get a guaranteed four-hour match no matter what happens, and somebody will, like, cry. Count me in.
Take my money for Andy Murray. Exactly. Every single time. We love you, man. Get back, hopefully healthy. As we said, we want to see the best Andy Murray we can see at Wimbledon, because I have a feeling that might be the swan song that he sails out onto, and it would be fantastic to see him do well there. And so we're thinking of you, Andy, and hopefully you're back as strong as ever for those tournaments. Actually, something that we did forget, and I know we're flipping back to the Chicky Babes, but Coco Gauff, again, like, we have sort of talked about this a little bit, but, you know, since the US Open, look, she played a great match at the Australian Open, and that was definitely the match, sort of, other than the Rybakina Blinkova.
That was the drama. But quality-wise,
quality was great.
The quality between Gauff and Sabalenka was the best match of the women's tournament, you want to say, right? At the Australian Open.
Yes, it's at certain points in that match.
Yeah.
But she has been struggling. And, you know, we've talked about Per Riba, his influence over her on the forehand in particular. He was working really hard. We've talked about it before, how Brad, you know, doesn't really want to change too much about that. But the thing that I'm really... Yes, the forehand. We can talk about the forehand till we're, you know, old and buried. But it's the second serve for me that she's struggling with. So there is certainly two things that are glaringly giving her problems that other players in the top 10 in the world do not have those glaring problems, except Garcia's return of serve. Mm-hmm. But Garcia, you know, has this great serving motion and wins most of her service games. Whereas Coco, I just don't know what's going to happen anymore. Is she going to double fault 10 times a match? And that's giving away two or three games on your serve. If you're not returning unbelievable, you're going to lose those matches against these types of players. So Coco has got to figure out something with the second serve. Motion is a disaster.
It wasn't this bad. It wasn't as bad as it was in Indian Wells.
But still.
She hit only three double faults against Caroline Garcia in a three-set match. The only thing that was a little bit concerning to me was the first two sets were actually amazing against Caroline Garcia. Caroline was playing incredible in the first set. She was just so aggressive, taking the balls early, rushing Coco. And Coco... we have the microphones in the boxes so we can hear what they are saying. And Brett was not saying much. And Coco, on her own, figured out that she has to play differently. She didn't have any depth, especially on her forehand. And in the second set, she started, we had the stats. She started playing
the ball over the net.
10 inches higher. I don't know in inches, but the centimeters. It was like 10 centimeters higher than in the first set. And what does height do? Height gives you depth. And all of a sudden, she won 6-1 or 6-2 the second set really easily. And then this is what I admired about Coco's game always. She reads tennis incredibly
well.
She's
really smart out there.
She's so smart. She has such high tennis IQ, and she's able to adjust. And that's what being a tennis player is. You constantly adapt. You adapt to new conditions every week. You adapt to new playing styles. Then you beat somebody. Then you play them the next week. They have changed their game. You have to adapt again. So what you are as a tennis player is basically somebody who consistently has to adapt and change and grow and do something differently. And Coco is the master of it. She's so good at it.
And the heart of a lion.
And of course, she's a warrior. We talked about her being an incredible competitor, in my opinion, one of the best on the tour, maybe the best with Caroline Wozniacki. But in the third set against Garcia, she went back to playing flat. And that was so strange to me, especially on the forehand side, because that's the one thing. We talked about it many times. When she has the height on the forehand, it's really uncomfortable to play her. I played her multiple times. Because on the one side, she hits the ball, and on the other, it jumps over your shoulder. And you're like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And that was really strange to me, because normally she's so good in reading the game. And there she kind of lost clarity in that third set. That was the only observation I had. I have no reasoning, or I don't have any consequences out of it. But that was interesting to me to witness, because we have the stats, and we saw that she went back to the first set again in terms of height. tight over the net.
Yeah, so, well, she'll be aware of that next time. But anyway, I wanted to throw that in there because, you know, these are the big names in the women's game that didn't have the tournament.
So do you want to talk about Iga as well? Or
no,
you...
I mean, listen, it is what it is. She lost to a, you know, big hitter and she kind of freaked out a little
bit. And it is, we talked, I don't know if we talked about this, but this is talked about all the time. It is so hard to win a Sunshine double.
Yeah.
And but because basically you're playing two Grand Slam tournaments in a row, more or less, little bit, it's a little shorter, but it's still a lot of tennis and you hit a wall.
Yeah.
And sometimes you are lucky that you scrape by and then for semis and finals you are there again.
Yeah.
But oftentimes you hit
it's
a
quarters.
Wall.
Yeah.
Yes. You hit a wall in quarters, last 16 quarters, you hit a wall. And if you're not lucky with the draw and you play somebody that's on fire, like Iga played with Alexandrova or Coco played with Garcia, you will be out.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. If you overcome these somehow luckily, then of course for semis and finals you'll be there
again. You're locked
again.
Back in and, yeah. And you're the better player in most times Iga's the better player in those semis and finals, right?
Yeah.
But speaking of a double sunshine double, Alcaraz, who looked unbelievable, but the courts suit Alcaraz and Iga in Palm Springs so much because of the grittiness of the court. Then you go to Miami, it's faster, the balls are different, it's humid, it's just very different conditions. And like Lindsay Davenport just won Indian Wells so many times because she's from California. She's used to those conditions. Could never do well in Miami. Same thing. So, but Alcaraz, I mean, Grigor Dimitrov, how happy are we for that guy? I mean, he played unbelievable.
He played so good.
Against Alcaraz. It was like just...
Against Zverev too.
Against Zverev, against everyone.
That was even crazier to me because of the he had lost the last seven matches against Zverev. So that was even crazier to me than the Alcaraz thing.
And there's a little bit of personal stuff there with them.
Well, and Dimitrov said it against Alcaraz, he kind of had no choice. It was like, I'm playing right now. At this moment, he won Indian Wells. So I play the most informed player here. I have to do something special. And it forced him. But to do it again a day later or 2 days later.
Especially when he lost the second set against Zverev.
Yes. And he choked in that second set.
He
had 5-4. He was 6-4, 5-4, love 30. And he missed two forehands in the bottom of a net. I'm sorry, that's a choke. Yeah. And you can say that now because he managed to win the third set. And he didn't choke even a little bit. But he choked in that second set.
He choked those points. And he played a very tactically terrible tiebreak. And I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden he started playing every ball
to the backhand.
To the backhand of Zverev. And he has the ability with a slice backhand, he has the ability to hit the slice down the line. So as somebody who hit a slice a lot when I played, if you hit hard to my slice, I could slice it to my one-handed backhand. It's very hard to run over there and hit that one-hand backhand against a two-hander when they were like dominating you on that side. But the ability to be able to hit a slice backhand like an Ash Barty and just go boop and hit slice down the line, then you're like, where do they go? They run over. Zverev is like 6'6". To run over on his weaker side, he's always going to hit that back cross court to Grigor's best shot. It's like, why isn't he doing that? All of a sudden, he's like trying to slice back cross court. Cross court again. I'm like, oh my God, you're going to his best shot. And then Zverev just controlled every single point on the backhand. And then in the third set, he just played smarter again, played the forehand. Oh my God, the break point where
so
the ball
good.
Hit the tape when he came into the net and he fell down and he made that that is one of the shots of the year to break. It would be one thing if it was like 15 or whatever.
Yeah.
Because, listen, I've had balls come off the net. And, you know, I mean, I made money from hitting reflexes at the net. So for me, it wasn't like, oh, my God. But trust me, I was on the ground on that one because of the importance of that point. When it hit the tape and he fell on the ground to make the shot, that was one of the shots of
the year. Yeah, and I mean, there were so many things adjacent to it that you don't see when you just see the shot. It was the first time in 260 weeks that he was back in the top 10. It was the first time in 8 years or whatever that he beat two top five player back to back. It was the first time in 5,000 years that he made a Masters 1000 final again. So there were so many things on the line and that moment. So it's not just the ball hits the tape, goes up and you're reacting to it. It's like, if I make this, I'm winning this match.
Yeah.
And all this like rat tail comes with it.
And
of
he
things.
Served it out
yeah.
so
incredible,
well. Like so calm, so great, so happy for this
he
guy.
He was serving so well because his second serve is kind of shite, and he was serving really well. And he had a few, very, very few, where you could tell the old second serve was coming out, where yeah. he just puts it in. It was like 68 miles an hour. And I was like, I can run faster than that.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, 95% of the tournament, Grigo was serving so well. And not only he has a great serve, but he's not the fastest serve on tour. But his spots
are almost
like Roger Federer's.
And that's the difference. And that's the difference. We've talked about it before. We talked about Alcaraz, how Jim Courier said that, you know, Alcaraz's biggest like downfall is the fact that he doesn't spot serve as well as the top guys. Like, you know, obviously how Roger served, how Sinner is serving now, how, you know, all the big servers. Zverev, when he hits his first serve in, it's like it's spot serving. It's so good. Whereas Alcaraz is about a foot from the sideline, whereas these guys are serving 1 inch from the sideline.
And Grigo was doing
and
that
Grigo, that's where Grigo. But also I feel like Grigo's changed his forehand a little bit. And I give Jamie Delgado, his coach, a lot of credit because they've been together now for a couple of years. And Jamie sort of oscillated between Andy Murray and Grigo. And then Jamie's with him all the time now, and I just give him a lot of credit. And he looks to me like he's changed something a little bit on his forehand. And as good as his forehand before was, I feel like there's something with the take back that looks a little bit different. And I think he's just playing with so much confidence now, and I love it. And he comes into the net as much as anybody.
I mean, he's so
and
good
he's
at the
so
net.
Good
yeah.
and he's fast, and he just understands how to move forward, and I am here for it, and
yeah.
I
and
love him.
The biggest difference that it is to him when he's playing well and not well, and I've always said it when people come up to me like, oh my god, do you know Grigor Dimitrov? He's like baby Federer. And I was like, yeah, with the difference that Roger plays on the line and Grigor plays 20 feet behind the line. Like, he looks like he plays like Federer, but it's like Federer.
And also the serve.
Yes, but
Federer
both.
Used to go in, because I went, it's funny that you said that, but I went one time at the Australian Open, I sat courtside on the baseline, right? So right where the tournament director sits there, where Craig Tiley sits, I sat there one time to watch him play. And I'm like, I think he played Roger. So I was like, what is the difference between these guys' serves? Because they do similar action, like the whole thing. And I was like, oh, it's so obvious. Roger would land first and second serve about, I would say, a good 2 to 3 feet inside the baseline. So when he's hitting his serve, he is going for it. And he is, you know, the confidence that he has to get inside the baseline and stay there and then maybe get back, you could see it. And then as Grigor was serving, particularly the second serve, even the first serve, he would go up and hit the serve. And as he came down, he was landing on the baseline, on the baseline, or maybe an inch inside the baseline. I'm like, that is terrible.
Yeah.
You have got to be inside the baseline hitting your serves. Look at all the great serves. Look where Serena would finish, inside the baseline. He was going up. It was almost like he was going up, hitting, and coming down and going backwards.
Yeah, but I know why.
I was like, what the
you
fuck?
You know why? Because he was afraid to take the balls on the rise. He needs time, and that's why he would revert back and be
trying to use
feet
his
behind
speed.
It. Yes, and because he's so fast, he could get away with it. Yeah. Now, he's not Roger playing on the line, but he's playing many more shots closer to the line, and he tries to take them on the rise, and it looks like they've been working on it. He's quick up to the short balls. That's why it's also easier for him to come to the net, because
backhand
he recognizes.
Looks bigger.
Yes, so he has really, I think, the main difference in Grigor's game from when he's not playing well to now when he's playing really well is he's much closer to the baseline. He takes many balls on the rise, and so yeah.
And he comes in, and
yes.
And he uses his speed
and
in
just,
the right. You know what it is? He's finally using his speed in the right way, which is forward, not parallel and side to side, 20 feet behind the baseline.
Yeah.
And just going, look, I'm really fast. I'm going to run this down, because he's not that guy. Look, it's one thing for Rafa or Medvedev to be 20 feet behind the baseline because they're counter punching and then they step up and go bang.
And they don't have a one-handed backhand.
And they don't have a one-handed backhand.
I mean, you had a one-handed backhand. The further back you stay, the
good
shittier
luck.
It is for your backhand.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For
also,
sure.
Your slice, if you try to hit a slice
and you can't get
from
in.
20 feet behind the back, you have to float it. And
yeah.
if it floats, the guys
dead.
Will kill it. But now he's taking it on the rise. He's taking the speed of the opponent, and he's like Steffi Graf did, or Roger, best example, he's like fucking slicing it.
Yeah.
He's not floating it. Yeah. He's slicing it. Exactly. And now even the guys who have good hands, they're like, oh, I have to go really underneath this. And you would see them forehand slice it back because it's so sharp the way he hits it.
Yeah.
It's
just Steffi graphing it. I love that.
Yeah, Steffi graphing it. But he's really improved, like, tremendously. It's not like one, two aspects. There are like four aspects in his game, from serve to positioning to slicing to forehand. And all of that helps him organically come to the net more often, where he was always good.
Yeah.
And the combination of that is why he's deservedly in the top 10 again. And if he can continue this way, will be a contender at the biggest tournaments every single time. You do not want to have him in your draw.
Absolutely. I think the key is, because he's being a little bit more aggressive with his, where he's standing on the baseline and how he's playing, is that it's allowing him, when he tries to get into the net and get these guys who are out of position, he's able to take three steps, maybe four, and be in a really good position at the net. Whereas before, he would have to take six steps because he was so far behind the court and try and hustle his way into the net. And these guys would pass him. And I was like, fuck, I can't keep coming in. Yeah, you can, but you've got to start here, not way back there. So I think that's the difference. Just his positioning in the court, he's hitting his backhand bigger. I think he's absolutely physically stronger than he was going through that long COVID situation, which we talked about already on the pod. So I think everything is falling into place perfectly for him. And I would love to see him make a Grand Slam final. I would love to see him have that opportunity again. Do I think he can beat the Sinners and Alcarazes in Grand Slam final over best of five? I don't know. I don't want to ever say no against anyone, because lightning in a bottle could happen. But I just love to see him make another Masters 1000 final, because he deserved it so much this tournament. But my God, best player in the world right now. I know Alcaraz won in Indian Wells, but I think there was something going on with Sinner a little bit in the final. And I also think that court is perfect for him in for Alcaraz in Indian Wells. I think this court is more indicative of the US Open. I think Sinner is the absolute favorite to win the US Open.
And Wimbledon too.
And possibly at Wimbledon. I actually think the US Open may be even faster than Wimbledon, believe it or not.
Yeah, it is true.
Because the grass is so slow now and hard underneath, so it bounces high. But my God, Jannik Sinner. I mean, he smoked Medvedev. I know Medvedev was tired, because guess what, everybody? Yes, I love that you keep tweeting us this. Shitty draw once again. He can second on like almost every match. I think when he plays in the day now, he must be like, oh, what's that up there? Oh, that's the sun. Because the guy plays late every time, which doesn't help him when it comes down to playing the Jannik Sinners of the world or the Alcarazes in semis and finals. But he gets a shitty schedule every time. But he got smoked, I mean, by Sinner. And then Sinner smokes Grigor in the final. The guy is playing unbelievable. And you could not have a nicer guy winning matches. We're so lucky in tennis with these players.
We are. So Jannik Sinner. First of all, Swaggy Sinner. He's gotten a little swag to him. Good for him. Like, I supported
Jannik Sinternet.
Jannik Sinternet. I fully support Swaggy Sinner. And the reason for that is a boy has become a man, and a man is now dominating the tennis world. And the man's
and
name
nice
is
man.
Swaggy Sinner, and I'm here for it. So that's number one. The other thing I will say is coaching matters. Darren Cahill is a great coach. The reason why I say this, I called the match against Griekspoor, who was playing absurd tennis. Jannik was not doing many things wrong. It was just that one day. And Griekspoor can play. He has a big serve. He can come to the net. He has a huge forehand. He was not missing
his
backhand. He has, like, he doesn't care. You can tell he's already put Novak one time to the brink of a loss at the Paris 1000 Masters in indoors. So he knows how to play the big players. And he came out there, and his backhand is weaker, and Jannik was attacking the backhand, but it was not breaking down. He was just holding fast a set and a half, and the rain came. He walked off, and until then, Griekspoor had won 86% of first and second serves. He was serving out of his ass, to be honest. And they come back, and all of a sudden it drops to 50%. I'm like, I wonder why. I see Darren Cahill the next day, and I'm like, Darren, did you tell Jannik to cover the wide serve? And Darren was like, yes, but he got aced twice down the middle. And I was like, that's okay, because we have the stats. And I showed him and he was like, oh my God, yes. And yeah. So even though Jannik got aced twice down the tee because he was covering the slice serve more, it changed the complete outcome of the match. And him having the trust in Darren Cahill, number one, B, being able to execute it, because that's a whole different story. I can cover whatever I want. If Griekspoor hits a serve at me, I can stand there. I won't return it, you know? So yeah. It matters to be able to execute, number two. And number three, he remained calm. He recognized, and this is what I always tell people, when you are losing, there is one single assessment you have to make. One single assessment. Am I doing something wrong? If the answer is no, wait for it, wait it out. Yeah. Or is the other one, and that's the second assessment, is the other one playing really, really well and I have to accept it and continue to do my thing and hope that it ends? And that's what Jannik did. He waited it out and it broke down and Jannik won 6-1 in the third. And after that, I was like, this guy's winning the tournament. Swaggy Sinner.
Or am I standing too close to the baseline on return my name is Caroline Garcia? So you're right. And you said it in the commentary, actually, when he was playing Griekspoor, because I was watching that match. And you said, sometimes you just have to wait it out when you're playing again. It's one thing if you're playing against Novak.
Yes, of course.
And he's killing you because yes. He's hitting the service spots. You can't get a free point on return because he's never missing one and blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's the first assessment by am I doing something wrong? Is like, am I tactically maybe? Yep. Like, first of all, am I just playing bad? Then you can't do anything except for try better. But am I doing tactically something wrong? And if the answer is no, this is the match plan we prepared. I know this is his weakness and it's just not weakening today. Then you have to continue and wait it out.
And you'll hear coaches often say, I've said this many times, I'm sure you've said it many times to yourself in your own head. It's just like you yell to your player, just...
She can't keep it up. That's like so many times my coach told me, like, she can't keep it up. Playing out of her ass.
Yeah, yes. Like if someone said, you know, if you know that this person hits her forehand cross court, you know, 85% of the time, every single match, and then all of a sudden she's hitting 70% down the line off the forehand and she's making every one of them and you're like, what the fuck? She's like, don't worry. Under pressure, and that's the key, under pressure, they will always do what they always do. And that's the bottom line. And if they don't, that's what you say, too good. And sometimes as a coach, Darren will understand this, when he got aced twice down the tee, you go, too good. That's too good. You made him or her hit the shot they don't want to hit under pressure. And if they can do that, that's when you can actually, as a player, believe it or not, because it sucks to lose every time. But when you know that someone has beaten you with their weakness because it was too good, that's a time you can walk away and go, fuck, that was just too good.
And
there's nothing I can do about that.
Happens once a year.
Yeah.
Maximum. Maybe twice a year. And this is what happened to Iga against Alexandrova. That's what happened to her. Unfortunately, it happened twice this year to her with Noskova and Australian Open. But that a lower ranked player, or for amateurs at home, somebody that you know that you're better than normally, you know.
They had a good day.
That happens once or twice a year where you're like, accept.
Too good.
You just did it.
Yeah, too good.
I gave you everything I could, and normally it breaks down. Today it didn't. And if Jannik had lost this match, everyone would have been like, oh my God, what's happening to Jannik Sinner? But every single person who watched the match would have been like, Griekspoor, man, he played out of his ass. Yeah. Good for him.
Yeah. I mean, and that's
and then
just
the worst is he would probably have lost the next round, like 2 and 3, and people and probably. Jannik would have killed
him. I mean, it was kind of like Blinkova at the Australian Open.
Yes.
You know, played the match of her life and then lost the next day. But listen, here's the bottom line. Jannik Sinner, without question, is the best player in the world right now on the men's side.
Griekspoor did look a little tired today.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's normal. He's, you know, the amount of great players he beat in a row and he played late. And yeah, so there's no question. But Jannik Sinner, without question, is the best player in the world currently on the men's tour. I know Alcaraz won last week, but this guy has started the year winning the Australian Open, winning in Europe indoors immediately afterwards. And one of the things that I know I talked to Darren about after he won the Australian Open was he was immediately saying, yep, he's playing great. It's awesome. We just have to keep him focused on the next and wanting to keep winning. And congratulations to not only Darren, but who's his other coach? I always forget his name, the Italian
Simone
guy.
Vagnozzi. Yeah,
exactly.
They've 22-1. Boyfriend is 22-1, Swaggy Sinner, this year. That tells you all.
And he lost arguably to a guy that's or could possibly win 10 Indian Wells titles with Alcaraz.
Yeah.
And so,
well, and we said, we commentated on this before, the difference right now between Carlos and Sinner is when they play each other, it's a lot of form of the day plus conditions. And currently, though, Carlos still has matches where he doesn't play his best. And Yannick doesn't have those.
Yeah, he plays great all the time.
Yes, he plays great all the time. And I repeat myself against Griekspoor. He also played. He maybe didn't play great, but he played good.
He didn't play bad.
He didn't play bad. And Carlos still has these bad matches.
And I think, and I want to go back to the women just for 1 second before we end this. Someone like Rybakina, who's coming off injuries and sicknesses and all this sort of stuff. And she didn't play great, right? She was missing her backhand quite a bit, which doesn't happen. She wasn't acing all over the place. You know, she's going to be, I think she's the absolute favorite to win Wimbledon, in my opinion. I think she's the player to beat there this year. So if you're going to put on an early bet from Wimbledon, I would put it on Rybakina because I think she's going to be really, really tough to beat there. And, I just think the women's game is so healthy right now, and the men's is being dominated essentially by two guys in Alcaraz and Sinner, and Novak will be back. We know that for sure.
Oh, the split with Goran.
Oh, should and the we split talk with Goran. That? I mean, Novak's had splits now with his management company, two managers, the two Italian husband and wife that were his agents forever. Mm. Got rid of them at the start of the year, had a new team in place. Now Goran's gone. There's definitely something tumultuous happening in Novak Djokovic's life. I don't know what's going on. And the cryptic tweet that he put out about Goran, you know, this and that, and then he would be like, he might not think about it that way in a bracket, like in a parenthesis, sort of like a sly little passive-aggressive comment about Goran. Like, I read that like, you wanted this, but clearly Goran was not happy. Because I could just from the tweet, right. I don't know. I haven't spoken to anybody. I could be talking completely out of my ass. But there's certainly something that's going on in that camp that's very tumultuous. Mm. And I don't know what it is. You might know more than me because of your Serbian connections. But there's something that's certainly not going right in Novak Djokovic's world right now. And so, look, he's always bounced back from stuff, but he's also not getting any younger. So it's getting tougher. And these guys are getting better. Yannick Sinner, Alcaraz, they're not going away. So he's going to have to come back and be at his best. Obviously, Rafa's going to hopefully come back and play some decent tennis on the clay before he goes off into, you know, Mallorca land and sails the seas and doesn't play tennis anymore. We've got a lot to look forward to with this clay court season coming up.
Yeah,
I am fucking here for it.
Me too. The only thing I will say, what drives me insane, especially when I do watch the Rybakina versus Sakkari match, is that our top five women are almost never playing each other.
Yeah, because they keep losing.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
So every time, like Sakkari right now, during the Sunshine Double, she was a top five player. She was top five before. Yeah. She was number three ranked player in the world before. Like when she plays this way, she's a top five player. She was a top five player. Rybakina, we all know, is a top five player. They play each other and it's incredible level. Coco Gauff and Sabalenka at the Australian Open.
So that's what you want to see.
Incredible. They never play each other. How is this possible? We've had 10 tournaments this year and we had two matches where top five women played each other. How is this possible?
As you say
and
in Germany.
This outburst is me as a tennis fan.
Yeah?
This is me as a tennis fan, not as a tennis expert, not as a former tennis player, as a tennis fan, because every time I see these matches, I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, this is the best thing ever.
So this is what you want before we end this pod, because it's been a long one. You want the top women playing against each other more often. Okay, because we want these great matches. And we want to see Novak back playing at his best. We want to see Rafa back healthy, playing some good tennis on the clay.
And we want the Danimal to keep up her form.
And we want the Danimal to keep it going this year because she is always fun to watch. And I love it. And I was here for that last game. Was so Danielle Collins. And I was here for it.
And you know what I'm also looking forward to? We didn't talk a lot about her, but we talked a lot about her during the Indian Wells episode. I'm excited to watch Iga on clay again because I know that some find her boring. I mean, I don't understand it because I feel like she's similar. Andy Roddick said it on his last podcast. It's a great podcast, by the way, Served. Not that you go away from us. You can listen to two podcasts at the same time.
Just our two.
But
I mean, we're all professionals.
Yes,
you really should only be listening to us.
But he said it really, fantastically about Novak Djokovic. He was explaining his game, like how it feels to play him and what he does and why it's so tough to play him. And he was saying that the way he plays doesn't maybe, his genius doesn't maybe fully present itself to an untrained eye, but to a trained eye, to somebody who has played on this level, it's like, what this guy is doing is incredible. And Iga, to me, is similar in that regard. That, yeah, to an untrained eye, people will be like, she's the best in the world. But if you've played before, you're like, motherfucker, is she good.
Yeah, yeah.
And clay is just her best.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm excited to see her on clay again, because, yeah, it's just, when I watch her, I get actually goosebumps now. I'm like, this is what I wished I could do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this,
yeah,
is what I wished I could do. Like the forehands from the center of the court.
The sliding, the back, open hand.
Sliding,
backhands,
the, yeah, athleticism. Yeah. Just the, like, I'm excited for that again.
Does have to, I think, keep working on the serve. That's, yeah, the one thing we talked about the last, yeah, you know, she's got to have, to me, she's got to take away that pause in between the take back,
Can she hire you just for service?
Maybe.
Just for service.
Iga.
Not for service in a sense that you service her with tea in the morning and coffee.
I'm not going to serve her tea, but I would love to just help that service motion. There's no question about it. But I am available, Iga. I know Daria listens to the podcast. She's actually quite a long listener to our podcast, her sports psychologist. So I am available. I'm available for serves and volleys for anybody. You know, just throwing that out there. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast. It was a long one, but we've had two or three, four great weeks of tennis. The Sunshine Double is over. Congratulations to Danielle Collins and, of course, Jannik Sinner. Well done. You're just two of my favorite people. So it was great to see you win. And also, Danielle Collins has been mentoring three young tennis players.
That, yeah.
And it's just little things like that that you don't know about Danielle. You kind of look at her, you either love her or you hate her, but I hope you love her because she's worth loving. And so is Jannik Sinner.
Danielle the Danimal and Jannik Swaggy Sinner.
And nobody has a tattoo inside their lip.
What?
Like Danielle Collins does.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my God, I have
it
to look it up now.
Savage.
She's a savage. She's an icon and a savage.
Yeah, we love her. So congrats to both. All right, guys, we will see you on the clay courts. We can't wait for it. Of course, Petco can't wait to see Iga crushing it on the clay as well. So everybody, thanks for listening to us again. And you'll hear from us real soon somewhere.
Bye. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.